This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Pope Francis recently spoke at a mass attended by Armenian leaders. His comments resulted in outrage from the Turkish government.
La nostra umanità.
In the past century, our human family has lived through three massive and unprecedented tragedies. The first, which is widely considered the first genocide of the 20th century, struck your own Armenian people, the first Christian nation.
Yes, it was the term genocide that made the country of Turkey angry. Today marks the 100th anniversary of what has been widely referred to as the Armenian Genocide. It resulted in the deaths of approximately 1.5 million Armenian people. Today, Where We Live, we will mark the centenary of this mass killing. We'll talk to historians and Armenian Americans, and we want to hear from you. Join our conversation if you have stories from relatives who may have lived through this period. If you're not from the Armenian community, how much do you know about what happened 100 years ago today? You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, wnpr.org/where we live, and you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Joining us today from our New Haven studios are three guests who will take us through the story and help us get a little bit more clarity on this history. Dennis Papazian is founding director of the Armenian Research Center at the University of Michigan, Dearborn, where he's a professor emeritus. Dennis, welcome to our program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And Mary Papazian is president of Southern Connecticut State University. She's also MC for New York City's observance being held tomorrow in Times Square. Welcome back to the program, President.
Thank you, John. It's great to be here with you.
And also Robert Barsamian, who's an artist whose exhibit is called Ashfall. We'll be talking about it in a bit. It's now on display at Southern Connecticut State University. Thank you, Robert, for being here as well.
Thank you very much, John.
Again, if you'd like to join this conversation, 860-275-7266. You can email us wherelive@wnpr.org. Because you're in a different studio and you all know the story so well, I'll let each or any of you pick up the story as I begin to ask questions about the history. But first, I guess I'd like to know why today is the day that we're marking this genocide that clearly took quite some time and happened in many stages over many, many years. Why is it today that we're marking this 100th anniversary?
Well, actually, the genocide chiefly took place during 2 years, 1915 and 1916. It then extended in small batches, so to speak, until 1923. So on the 24th of April, 100 years ago, the Turkish government arrested Armenian intellectual leaders, clergymen, newspaper editors, thinkers, professors, etc., and sent them to a place where most of them were killed in order to deprive the Armenian people of their natural leadership. Secondly, what they did was to draft the young Armenian men into the army, and then after the Balkan Wars, where they fought heroically for the Ottoman Empire, they were disarmed, put in labor battalions, and then killed. Finally, after the young men who were able to resist were gotten rid of, the old men, the old women, children, were sent on death marches to the Syrian desert. Some never made it because there are massacres on the way there. Horrible things happened. We don't have the time or the inclination to talk about them at this point, but very few survived. Some got to Deir Zor in the Syrian desert, and even there were 30,000 massacred. It was a horrible situation. This was recognized, actually, by the Turkish government right after the genocide. They held war crime trials. These trials convicted certain leaders of guilt and in absentia because they had fled. And what happened then was that they closed down these trials because Ataturk was arranging through military action to drive out the Sultan's government and to take his place with his own Ataturk government supported by the Young Turks. And so this is the situation where it then was denied. And those countries that have relationships with Turkey to their own personal advantage go along with the Turkish denial, and most people throughout the world admit the truth and talk about a genocide.
We'll talk a bit later on in the program about this term. We've done programs about the power of words like genocide in the past, and we'll be talking more about that. Mary Papazian, I'm wondering if you can elaborate a bit on why this particular day is important to you to mark in the way that, that is being marked around the world.
Well, as my husband just explained, it is this day that has really come to be the single day where we commemorate as Armenian communities and knowledgeable people around the world of the events that took place over a period of several years. But it's the one symbolic day. It's the day when the head of the nation, and again, you know, clergymen, poets, writers, leaders were gathered together in the dead of night and taken out and slaughtered. And so, you know, there's always that symbolic moment, that symbolic place where we focus our attention. What you see, it's if you think about New Year's Day, you know, the beginning of the new year and the ball drops in New York City, but we watch all through the day as New Year turns all across the world. The same happens with Armenian communities across the globe, from Australia all the way through the Middle East to Europe and here in America. As April 24th comes around, we all, you know, come together as a common bond of humanity. And commemorate you know, something that was truly horrific.
Obviously, depending on who is telling the story, the reasons given could be very, very different. But from your perspectives, what are the reasons why this happened, why this roundup of intellectuals, why this ongoing killing that stretched in waves until the 1920s? Why did this happen? Why did the Ottoman Empire do this to the Armenian people?
I think that we have to look back at what the Ottoman Empire was, and that it was a group of different peoples living within a physical state, an empire. The Armenians and the Turks occupied Anatolia, today what is called Turkey, and the Turks felt that they had to rid that area of non-Turks so that they could establish a nation state. It becomes a little complicated, but it's a transition from an empire to a nation state. And the Armenians were in the way of that nation state. First, they were Christians and not Muslims, and they were Armenians and not Turks. And so the Turks found them to be a problematic situation and decided to settle the problem by killing all of the Armenians, which is a remarkable thing, but which is the way they thought in those days, apparently.
We're talking today about the 100th anniversary of the Armenian Genocide, and we're talking with scholars and Armenian Americans about this. And if you wanted to join us, 860-275-7266, especially members of the Armenian American community, we'd love to hear your voices today. You can also email us wherelive at WNPR.org. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at wherelive. Robert Barsamian, we're going to be talking about your art exhibit called Ashfall in a moment, but I'd like to ask you how this date resonates with you personally.
Personally, it's an important day because my mother and grandmother were survivors of this event that took place, the genocide. So it's a day that I have to honor my ancestors who passed, and a day that I have to be thankful for that my parents, my mother and my grandmother were able to escape, but also because it's taken 100 years for us to get to this one point. And when you think about that, 100 years of denial of an event that really cannot be denied, it's almost sinful to think that it's taken this long for us to come to a point where we gather together in such large numbers now to say, we don't want this to be this way anymore. We want everybody to recognize this. And in its recognition, it's not just April 24th. It's from this day on, we must keep reminding people over and over again of the event.
You mentioned members of your family who survived the genocide. Robert, could you tell us what survivors tell you or that you've heard from others who've survived this tragic event? We've done many stories over the years about the Holocaust, the World War II extermination of Jews at the hands of Nazis, and how difficult it was for survivors of the Holocaust to talk about their experiences. And so we truly didn't know the real story because even though they survived, they didn't want their memories to in some way. Did you hear from people what happened, or was it hard to get those stories?
Well, in my case, personally, my experience was that it was extremely quiet. My mother or my grandmother did not speak of the event until a little later on in life, where there was an event that took place in Turkey. It was a big earthquake. And my grandmother and I, who spoke Armenian, were conversing one day and listening to the radio, and this news bulletin came across of this event. And my grandmother, who was the nurturer of the family, said to me in Armenian, "I wish I had the wings of a bird so I could fly over and see all the dead Turkish bodies." And I was just flabbergasted. I could not believe this woman, whom I just adored, would speak so harshly. And then from that day on, she started coming out with what happened to her, what happened to her mother, what happened to a lot of her cousins and relatives who were perished. And that was slowly revealed, but it took, I was in my 20s when that was happened.
And I would just jump in here, John. That was characteristic in the community. There were those certainly who spoke of it early, but if you think about the trauma that survivors endured and suffered and the kinds of things they saw, which were as horrific as you can imagine, you know, times 10, they couldn't talk about it. They were so focused on survival, putting food on the table and building communities again and raising families. It was about 50 years after the genocide in the 60s, as that 50-year mark, we're now 50 years later, sort of came, people realized, I think, that there was a need to start talking about this differently. This is when Armenian monuments started to be built. This is when the stories first became explicit. There, I think, was some level of shame, you know, what we had suffered. How do we talk about rape and murder and beheadings and all of those things in those days? I mean, it was very difficult. But once the floodgates opened, there was, a real attempt to get these stories out, these witnesses out. And so there were a number of oral history projects. Dennis was involved in one through the Armenian Assembly, and there were others. And, to try to have these survivors tell their stories on tape and on film. There's an Armenian filmmaker who's passed on now, well into his 90s, from California, J. Michael Hagopian, who taped something like 400 of these eyewitness accounts. They're now part of the Shoah Foundation Visual Archives at USC. As a real testimony to the events that occurred and the experience of individuals as witnesses to those events. It was trauma, and there was real post-traumatic stress in the Armenian community. But once it came out, people would cry, and over again in those oral histories, they would say, "I've never spoken about this before. My family doesn't know this." The tears would come, and once you began, it flooded out.
Mary, I have to actually ask you about something that I wanted to pick up on. Dennis had said earlier that, you know, we have neither the time nor the inclination to talk about some of the atrocities, the terrible things that happened. And as the president of a university that, among other things, trains journalists, people in my job, it's always a fine line, right, about how much we want to give the detail, how much we want to talk about what people saw, because it is so traumatic and it's so beyond the pale horrible. But can you talk a bit about getting to the nub, to the reality of what really happened? Not sugarcoating it, not using big broad terms, but actually saying, here are the horrors we saw. Or do you think that it's okay to stop short of that somehow because the words are so painful?
Well, I think there are is an importance of being truthful to the reality, and so I do think it matters to tell what happened in the most clear terms possible. And some of that is visual, and some of that is poetic. I think it's important for people to understand at an emotional level as well as at an intellectual level what those experiences are, because that is our common humanity. And if we're afraid of talking about things, we never really understand the truth. Obviously, there are ways and audiences to talk about different parts of it. We want our historians, certainly, to go into the great detail and to archive that so that it's there and our students understand it and people across the country and the world understand it. We want our filmmakers to be able to talk about it. We want our journalists to understand how to ask the right questions that get at the truth, but to be able to gauge their audience to know how much of that and how to present it. So I think it's very, very important that we understand all the details, but we're not here just to be gory and just to create sensation. And I think the real fine line is, how do you do it in a way that leads to greater understanding versus how do you do it to create shock only for the sake of shock?
Let me give a couple of examples. Sure. Since the question was asked. One way that people were killed, it was on the Black Sea coast. They were loaded into barges, taken out into the water of the Black Sea, and then dumped overboard to drown. Another way was to bury people alive, force them to dig graves and then throw them into the graves and then cover them with dirt. Others were hacked to death. There's just a story I read yesterday about women who were lined up and told to lie on the ground and then beheaded one by one. There's a story about a two-year-old child who was used as a ball in a game, a horseman's game, when they were thrown around. There are stories of people being thrown into the Euphrates River. Some jumped willingly to get away from the torturers. Most people arrived at the desert undressed because the clothing was worth money to the simple peasants, and they were forced to undress. And then, of course, with no clothes under the heat of the sun, they had sunburns, they turned black, many died. Most of them starved to death. So that those who survived generally were children or women who had been taken into Turkish, Kurdish, and Arab homes, either as servants or as members of the family. And these people were survived. I interviewed one woman who had tattoos on her face. We called her Hanum, or lady. And I said, why these tattoos? And she broke down in tears and said, I've never told this story. She said, I was taken in by Arabs and by these Arab tribes, and to have tattoos on the face was considered attractive. And then she was crying uncontrollably, and I said, what's going on here? And she says, I've never told anyone. She says, but I was taken into an Arab family. I had two sons. And then in the 1920s, when they came around and said, do you want to go back and become an Armenian or stay here? I chose to leave my children and to come and become an Armenian again. Mm. And she just shook uncontrollably. What happened to my children? What are they doing? What have I done? Mm. So there were all of these miseries. And another thing, there was a big cavern, and these people were thrown into the cavern. You couldn't see the bottom of it. There's pictures of this available. Then others were put in caves and then fires lit in order to gas them to death. So there were many, many horrible ways this was done. And it shames people because one of the American consuls who observed the results of this said he was ashamed to be a member of the human race after having seen what had happened.
And when we come back from our break in a few minutes, we'll be talking a bit about America's role in the memory. As we head to break, though, I want to take a quick phone call. Yüksel is calling from Hartford. Hello, Yüksel. You're on Where We Live.
Oh, hi, this is Yüksel Serenak. I'm working as a librarian at Trinity College.
Hi there. Hi. What's on your mind today?
Okay. I am from the town of Kurdish town of Bingöl. So in 84, I went to my village, and so I visited my relatives in the village, and then one of my relatives was married to our families, and she was actually an Armenian, and we walked to the graveyard. I think she used to visit the grave every day. I don't know why, but she just went to the graveyard. She started crying it just shaking and crying. It just so, I can't forget that moment. So, and then I asked her, and she talked about how she missed her relatives. She didn't even remember her relatives, parents and brothers and sisters. So I think she was brought from a camp in Mersin, which is on the Mediterranean coast, I don't know where, and then she got married to our relatives. That's what I want to tell. Mm. I have a question.
Certainly,
if I have
yes.
time. A lot of Kurds saved the Armenians, but then some Kurds also participated in the massacre. Okay, some Kurdish tribes and landlords, etc. So, can your guest comment on that? So, how the Armenians think about the Kurdish participation?
And Yüksel, thank you so much for your phone call, your story, and also your question. Dennis, I'm wondering if you could maybe quickly take a
I think I'm going to give that to Mary.
Okay, Mary.
Sure, and I appreciate the question. There's been many studies, of course, on the role of the Kurds. They were used by the Ottoman government at the time of the genocide to do many of these horrible things. But we had an opportunity as a family to travel to eastern Anatolia this past summer on the eve of the centenary. And we were in Diyarbakir, which is a Kurdish city, a very important Kurdish city in the heart of Anatolia, just east of the Euphrates River. And we had a time, about an hour, with the former mayor of the old city of Diyarbakir, Abdullah Demirbas, who is Kurdish and who spoke to us about the role of the Kurds and how it is his life's work to ensure that there is restitution and recognition for the terrible events that his forebears had done to the Armenians. And we're seeing much of this in the Kurdish community. He has been convicted of something like 400 years worth of jail time for his courage and his bravery in ensuring that the Armenian presence is reestablished. And it was under his leadership that the Surp Giragos Church in Diyarbakir, one of the real ancient Armenian churches from the 7th century, was reestablished. It's now a working church, and Armenians who have been hidden for 100 years have been coming out. Some are staying Islamicized, some are becoming Christians, but it's an incredible place of community building. And so, I would finally add that there are many Kurdish scholars who are doing some just incredible, work on the events of the genocide period that are going to be very, very important for our understanding. It was an incredible moment, and I think none of us who were there will ever forget it.
We should also remember that the head of the Kurdish party in the Turkish parliament recently apologized to the Armenians and said he wanted to somehow establish restitution. Mm-hmm. Finally, I must go back to Diyarbakir. In Turkey, the only monument to the Armenian genocide is in that town, and it was built by the former mayor, and it is described in five languages, so anyone who goes there will know what it means. And it is the only real genocide monument in Turkey. And so the Kurds, and I deal with some Kurds who are in Iraq, are repentant. They were used, and then they realized that in the 30s when the Turks turned against them.
I need to head to a break. Dennis Papazian, Mary Papazian, join us from the New Haven studios today. Dennis is the founding director of the Armenian Research Center at the University of Michigan, Dearborn. Mary is the president of Southern Connecticut State University. When we come back, we're going to be talking with artist Robert Barsamian, whose exhibit called Ashfall is now on display at Southern Connecticut State University as we mark the 100th anniversary of the Armenian Genocide. We'll take your calls at 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today on the program, we're talking with Dennis and Mary Papazian, who are both Armenian-Americans and scholars of the Armenian Genocide. And we're talking to them on this 100th anniversary as we mark this date. There's an event happening tomorrow in Times Square in New York City that Mary Papazian, the president of Southern Connecticut State University, will be the MC for. We're talking today about this anniversary, what it means not only to the Armenian people, but what it means to the United States and its relations with Turkey and the rest of the world. Also joining us from the New Haven studio today is Robert Barsamian, whose exhibit called Ashfall is now on display at Southern Connecticut State University. Robert, how does your exhibit, which focuses on the victims, how does it tell the story of the genocide?
Well, primarily it tells a story because each one of the elements are stories that were told to me either by my family or people who I interview concerning their involvement with the genocide and the events of the genocide. And I researched for a period of time and decided that I was going to create this body of work in honor of my ancestors and their memory, and I worked on it for about 20 years and resulted in creating a series of installations which have traveled in the United States dealing with this subject matter of memory and the memory of these that my family and other people had passed on to me.
Mm. What does the idea of memory mean to you? As we talk through this, we're getting tweets and emails from people like Pamela, who says that when she was in school, she never learned about the Armenian Genocide. Maybe kids are today. It gets us to this question, Robert, about how we develop memories over time when such a large part of history seems to not be a part of the larger public consciousness.
Well, that's a very important question. It's not, you know, I was denied an education of it, too, when I was going to school. Hmm. And the only reason I learned was because I had a family who was involved. And I am of an Armenian descent. And therefore, at one time or another, this story was passed on to me for whatever reasons and whatever time frame it happened. And then I began my own investigation. It wasn't that from that point that I was readily educated. I had to go and investigate. And fortunately, my investigation revealed a lot of information, and it conjured an anger in myself, an anger that I couldn't understand why this had to have happened to my family and other Armenian families, and also deny me a history. I have no history. I don't know about my ancestors, because there's no record of my ancestors. So somehow I wanted to bring to light the event that took place through the memory of others, which to me, their explanation is the biggest truth that you could have. Why would they lie about such an event? There's no reason for them to lie about such an event. But me as an artist, how would I interpret that? Now, I'm not a historian nor a scholar in the subject matter, but as an artist, I do have an obligation to be as truthful as I possibly can with the information that's given to me, as well as embellish it from an aesthetic point of view. So I wanted to do that in the best way that I could. When I first started doing these pieces, they manifested themselves harshly. They were about bones and skeletons and things like that. And I realized after the first two installations, I might not have to do that. I probably could reach a broader audience of people if I tried to show similarities in event, and not just specifically the Armenians, but people throughout culture and time and history have suffered such traumatic events. And so I slowly incorporate that work into my work. And of course, it's a focus on the Armenian culture because that's what I'm most familiar with. I wouldn't choose to use anything else that I'm not familiar with.
Well, Mary, so I think what Robert's saying is so interesting, though. It's preserving this bit of Armenian history and culture, certainly, but it's also in many ways linking what happened to your people to the larger problem of the world, which is time and time again over centuries, we have, for whatever reason, found groups that we do not like and that we systematically kill them. And it has happened not just here, and it has happened not just in the Holocaust, but it happens today in various countries in Africa and around the world. Can you talk a bit about that linkage, Mary, about how you want to preserve this particular memory, but you also, as a historian and a scholar, want to make sure that this is part of a continuum of stories about how terrible, frankly, man can be to one another?
Yeah, it's the whole idea of the inhumanity to man, and this is part of the reason that we have made this such a focal point this week at Southern Connecticut. We are an institution committed to social justice and the understanding of human history and human nature and human community and to making it better. And so we have to give our students and our broader community the tools to understand and to be able to make a difference. And that means, to go back to an earlier question, really facing the truth and understanding it deeply. We are, the Times Square event that you've referenced is actually on Sunday.
Oh, and I apologize.
That's okay. We have for all of our listeners here in Connecticut, we have a commemoration at the State House in Hartford on Saturday at 11 o'clock, and we welcome anyone to join us there. But the theme for the Sunday's commemoration is united against genocide. It's really a recognition that, genocide is not just a crime against an individual ethnic group or racial group. It is a crime against humanity. And that does link, in fact, all of us. And it's something we all have to understand, whether it happens to the Armenians or it happens to the Bosnians or it happens to the Jews or any people that is suffering in Darfur, you name it. And you're right. The 20th century is a very bloody century. The 21st century is turning out to be not much better. Mm-hmm. So we have some real serious, I think, work to do as members of the human race to understand this and in each in our way to try to make a difference. And we have the opening of Mashfall today at 5 o'clock at Southern in our new Bewley Library. It's going to be a wonderful event, and it will be followed by a recital by two young Armenian musicians from Armenia, but one who is here in Connecticut and another in Indiana, a composer, to really commemorate the continuum of music and how art really helps tell that story.
And we will have information about these events on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. Melina Tumani is an Armenian-American who went back to live in Turkey for 2.5 years. Late last year, she released a memoir about her time there called There Was and There Was Not. Let's listen to her talking to NPR's Weekend Edition.
People would find out that I was Armenian, and sometimes the reaction would be so blunt. Well, I guess you came here to prove that there was a genocide. I want you to know that I don't believe that that's what happened, or something like that. And those moments were really jarring and made it very difficult for me to ever really relax. There was a lot of stress in my daily life. And I want to be clear, of course, that I also had the opposite reactions. You know, there was a young man who I met outside of a restaurant with some friends just totally at random on a Saturday night. And when he found out I was Armenian, he put his hand over his heart and he said, "I want to welcome you back to your country and I want to apologize on behalf of the Turkish nation."
And again, that's Melina Tumani, an Armenian-American speaking to NPR's Weekend Edition. Does that story resonate with you?
Well, actually were at an event where Melina spoke just a little while ago, so I'm familiar with the book and I'm familiar with her experience. I think, Turkey is a very complex country. It was then and it is now, and there is very clear denialism. There's been an 80-year effort to propagandize the people. The government has just released history textbooks for the schools that deny the genocide. But on the other hand, there are progressive Turks, the first of whom who now lives in the United States was Taner Akçam, but there are others who live within Turkey who are doing some very courageous work to try to tell the real story. So there is a tension within Turkey itself on how to confront its own history. And I remember when Taner said this 10 years ago, and he said, "I love Turkey. It's who I am, and it's my country," he says. "So I need to help my country face its past so it can have a democratic future." It is still against the law in Turkey to speak openly about the Armenian genocide. But now we're getting these conflicting tensions. Even the most recent statement released by Erdogan, the prime minister of Turkey, talks about apologies on the one hand, and then, it sort of takes it back on the other. But there's a little more apology than there has been. So what Melina is really, I think, speaking to is that tension that is there. She's a little younger, so she didn't sort of grow up with the survivors in quite the same way that the generation above me did. And I think it's really important to see how the newer generation is starting to really understand and move forward. My final comment on this, though, is you can't move forward unless there's an honest reckoning with the actual experience.
Well, and Dennis, I'd like to ask you in the last 2 minutes that we have about that honest reckoning, because part of it here in America is America's reaction to that. Yes, there's a complicated history about this in Turkey, and maybe more apologies than there used to be, but still this state decision that we are going to deny this genocide. The fact that the United States has not joined the chorus of the rest of the world calling this a genocide, Dennis, what does that mean to you?
Well, I think the president this year has almost joined the chorus. If you see the statement which he issued, he says, this year we mark the centennial of the Medjugorje, which in Armenian means the great crime, the first mass atrocity of the 20th century. Beginning in 1915, the Armenian people of the Ottoman Empire were deported, massacred, and marched to their deaths. Their culture and heritage in their ancient homeland were erased amid horrific violence that saw suffering on all sides. 1.5 million Armenians perished. Now, if you go on with the president's statement, he references the Pope's statement and also the Raphael Lemkin, who invented the word genocide and modeled on the Armenian experience. And so he does it all and says his own view has not changed, and we're aware that he believes it was genocide. So I think it's the strongest statement he's made, and it's very little cover for the Turkish government, very little cover.
Dennis Papazian is founding director of the Armenian Research Center at the University of Michigan, Dearborn. Mary Papazian is the president of Southern Connecticut State University. Robert Bassamian is an artist whose exhibit called Ashfall is now on display at Southern Connecticut State University. If you'd like information about any of the events that we've talked about commemorating the 100th anniversary of this genocide, you can go to our website, wnpr.org/where we live. Thank you all so much for joining me. I really appreciate it. Coming up next, we're going to be talking about a bit of Polish history, which you can find just up the river in Chicopee, Massachusetts. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on Monday's show, military recruitment has a long and controversial history that continues today. Advances in technology and a generation of youth that are harder to reach with traditional methods have the military turning toward a new tactic, video games. While some argue this is unethical, others say there are great benefits for training, education, meeting recruitment goals, and veterans' health. That's our story coming up on Monday. Hope you can join us. The town of Chicopee, Massachusetts, first reported Polish settlers in 1880. It was the start of an influx of immigrants to the Connecticut River Valley to work as farmers and factory workers. Stanislav Radosz is working to keep that history alive at the Polish Center for Discovery and Learning. WNPR's Katie Talarski got a tour of the living monument in Chicopee with its founder.
Stanislav or Stasz Radosz is a storyteller and a historian. He's also a collector of things.
It all started with many decades ago when I was at UMass. A woman called me up and said, oh, I have a trunk that belonged to my mother, and there's some wooden shoes in there. And I said, oh, my God, I remember my mother talking about chodaki, wooden shoes, in the village. And I said, oh, my God, I only know them from stories. I'd love to see it.
She asked Radosz if there was a place to donate the shoes so that they could be preserved. At the time, there wasn't. Now the shoes are long gone, which is unfortunate because there is a perfect place, not only for the shoes, but old wedding dresses, folk art, ephemera, pierogi boards.
Well, I do have Babcia's pierogi board on the second floor.
Radosz has given me a tour through a 150-year-old rectory in Chicopee, Massachusetts. It fell into disrepair, and he proposed to take it over, turn it into a museum celebrating Polish culture and heritage in the region.
This had a wraparound porch here.
It would take $1.5 million, mostly donated materials and labor, to upgrade the 18-room mansion, adding a foyer and an elevator, repairing ceilings and walls, transforming it into the Polish Center of Discovery and Learning.
I think we're unique. There is no other Polish museum like this in the United States, except in Chicago. We're trying to preserve the history of the, say in Polish, Szarego Człowieka, the plain people who came and contributed to the success of this country. Unfortunately, a lot of the things that they brought with them, their story is often forgotten, and the things that they brought with them are being lost because they don't think that it's worth keeping.
Small details stand out, like a welded chandelier made especially for the museum by a local artist.
And he did that all by hand. he cut out the three historical capitals of Poland on the globe that you see there. Come take a look at it. So the first cutout on the globe is the first historical capital, Gniezno. Then the next one is the Renaissance capital over here, Kraków. And then the contemporary capital of Warszawa.
Even the wallpaper, a silk-screened William Morris reproduction from the early 20th century, all donated.
And we also have William Morris wallpaper in the bathrooms.
Radosz has collected thousands and thousands of pieces of history, and he's got a story for each and every one.
We have something very special over the fireplace here. Come take a look. There are only two of these in the world, one in Poland and one here.
He has a plaster cast of Pope John Paul II's right hand, enshrined in a stunning carved wood altar.
So here it is. And we had a special case made for it in Zakopane, one of his favorite places in the world, where he would go skiing.
You can get a sense of the historical span of this collection by looking at the hand of this modern pope and what's right next to it, a reproduction of Polish cavalry armor from the 17th century.
I've always wanted a winged hussar in the Polish center, and I said
the winged hussar. It includes a metal chest plate, helmet, and two rows of blue wings arching from the back over the top of the head.
Nobody really remembers why or knows exactly why. The feathers were something that you saw in all of Eastern Europe, the Balkans. Poland was an enormous country, and the winged hussar has become sort of a symbol of the spirit of Poland.
A visit to the Polish Center of Discovery and Learning is truly a history lesson.
And in it is a portrait, an enormous portrait of Marshal Józef Piłsudski.
Radosz is a Slavic bibliographer. He's taught classes at UMass and Elms College. This museum personifies a class he taught called Introduction to Polish People. All of the walls and corners are filled with reminders of the country's very complicated past.
In this case, a lot of people in America don't know, or they've forgotten, that the Germans and the Russians were allies. On the 1st of September, the Germans attacked Poland, the Polish military went east, and they were attacked on the 17th of September by the Russians. The Polish Air Force evacuated to England. The Polish military were taken to detention camps, and some people got to Romania. And here's a newspaper from 1939 published in Bucharest.
So what are some of the headlines?
Well, what's interesting is the headline here is that Nasze zwycięstwo jest pewne, our victory is certain. And there's also an article about Chopin's heart.
Chopin's heart is buried in Warsaw, separate from his body, which is in Paris. In the old dining room area, Radosz shows me more old books and newspapers, like the History of Polish Kings, published in 1860, encrusted in Moroccan leather.
Beautiful illustrations of the kings of Poland.
Radosz says he rents out the space for parties and gatherings, partly as a way to raise money. He wants to eventually add a small auditorium and a few classrooms.
Take you upstairs.
On the second floor, the rooms are divided into themes that defined the story of Poland in the 20th century.
This is Podróż do Ameryki, coming to America. And the first Poles came to America, North America, in 1608. Obviously, we don't have things from 1608. However, we do have things starting with the Great Immigration, 1880 after. The largest number of Poles came between 1904 and 1912.
There's a shawl from a woman who came through Ellis Island, trunks from the end of the 19th century, plates and silverware.
After World War II, the people who were in displaced persons camps, many times they stayed in the camps that they were in originally. And in this case, this is a little boy who was born in one of the camps in 1947, and he was given this plate as a remembrance of his baptism. When I turned it over, I noticed that there was a Nazi swastika and the date 1939 on it.
Radosz has also collected a lot of documents, like boat tickets and passports.
Nobody has the exact figure of how many people were taken to slave labor in Germany. I believe there was about 3.5 million, mostly whole families. In this case, the soldiers went to the father of this young man and said, select one of your children. And he picked the 13-year-old. And when he was in Germany, He had to wear a P on his clothing. You see it right here. And carry this special passport. He ended up surviving the war, coming to Chicopee. He's buried in St. Stan's Cemetery here in Chicopee. He never married, but he's buried with his best friend, his dog.
In another room, we find old family photos, along with wooden instruments for making cheese and sauerkraut, and for stuffing kielbasa.
There's the pierogi board.
Okay.
Okay, you can also make noodles on it, too.
In the contemporary Poland room, there's memorabilia from the Solidarity Movement and handkerchiefs that the Polish Air Force would send home to their sweethearts. There are accounts from Poles who were exiled to Soviet forced labor camps in Siberia during World War II, and a tribute to Wojtek, the Polish soldier bear.
I mean, have you heard about him? Mm-mm. It's a long story.
Radosz pointed to a small cartoon on the wall that explains the story, how after Polish prisoners were released from Siberia, they crossed the Caspian Sea to join the British Army in the Middle East. During that journey, the soldiers came upon a young boy selling things in a small bag.
Among them was a bear whose mother was killed by hunters, and it was just a little baby bear. So they bought that little baby bear, and it grew up to be... 5 feet tall, 600 pounds, ate 20,000 calories a day.
What did they do with it? Well, it was
the mascot. He pretty much lived with them, you know. He was allowed to ride with them in a truck, and he was just treated like a real human being, so much so that he was allowed 2 bottles of beer a day, which he picked up in his paws like a human being. He ate and smoked cigarettes. And he was actually made an official soldier of the army.
The bear apparently took part in the Battle of Monte Cassino. Years later, Wojtek ended up in the Edinburgh Zoo and stood as a symbol of the West until his death.
They've built a monument to him recently in Kraków.
There are more rooms in the mansion, a few which are in progress, and a replica of an old Polish farmhouse, also in progress. In a room celebrating the ingenuity of the Polish immigrant, there's part of an old Polish poem on a chalkboard.
At night, before you went to sleep, you'd go through your catechism. And then there was another kind of catechism, a national catechism. And you would learn some people say znak.
Who are you? I'm a little Pole. What's your symbol? A white eagle. Where do you live? Among my own. And what land? The Polish land. How was it acquired with blood and wounds? What do you owe it? I owe it my life.
There was a poem that was written, you know, during Poland's occupation under the partitions.
I asked Radosz a few times to tell me more about his background and his family. But as much as he wanted to talk about Polish history and culture, he didn't want to talk about himself. He only told me this much, that his parents loved their country and that he takes being Polish very deeply.
Why is it important for you to tell these particular stories?
Mostly because of my parents, to begin with, who were outrageously patriotic and left me somewhere between two countries.
My audio recorder ran out of space before my tour with Stasz Radosz ended, more than 2 hours after I entered the old rectory. There's a lot of history here, connecting Radosz to his past and preserving these stories for the future.
That's WNPR's Katie Talarski, reporting from Chicopee, Massachusetts. You can find out more about the Polish Center for Discovery and Learning at polishcenter.net. This Sunday, join us at the Little Poland Festival in New Britain. From 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., there'll be food, dancing, and celebration of Polish culture. You can find out more at littlepolandfest.com. Our coverage is part of our Polish Stories Project. There are more photos on our website at wnpr.org. Where We Live is produced by Lydia Brown, Tucker Ives, Betsy Kaplan, and Kion Wolf. Katie Talarski is the executive producer. Thanks so much to our digital editor, Heather Brandon. I'm John Dankowski. Have a great weekend.